We're staying here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us a Mr. Robert Precht, and we're going to be talking about his fascinating book, Defending Justice on Trial, or Defending Muhammad. Mr. Precht, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And, you know, there's that old joke about, you know, the fellow went to the graveyard, and on the tombstone it said, "Here lies an honest man and a lawyer," and he said, "Gee, that's got to be two people buried there." But after reading your book, I'm convinced that you are an honest man, and you are a lawyer, and you have a fascinating, fascinating story to tell. And, you know, it's a book that really sort of describes your feeling almost of almost impossible situation you were as a young lawyer being asked to defend one of the people who was accused of being involved with the first World Trade Center bombing, Mohammed Salameh.
Right.
Is Salima, how do you pronounce it?
Salami.
Salami.
Yes.
All right. It's I don't know how they come up with salami out of that, but I'm sure you know more than I do. How did you happen to get assigned to that? You were working for the public defender.
Right. I was working for the public defender, and I appreciate your kind remarks about the book. I really tried to present an honest portrayal of not only what a public defender does, but the criminal justice system. And basically, I was a public defender at the time, handling routine cases. If you can imagine an emergency room physician handling intake, that was my job, basically, that day. I was one of 12 lawyers, and were assigned 2 days, quite by random, a month, in which we simply accept the people who are brought to the courthouse and need a lawyer. And I was obviously flabbergasted and surprised to be appointed to represent this lead suspect in the case, especially because I had been used to, until then, handling very routine minor cases, never anything that could be described as high profile.
Yeah, but this was certainly high profile. Everybody in America was aware of the fact that they had captured or they had identified these men. There were four of them who were on trial for blowing up the World Trade Center. There were several who actually they didn't have that had already escaped, but you were, of course, defending one of them, and the man who was accused of actually driving the truck, wasn't he?
Right. My client, Salami, was accused of driving the van that carried the bomb into the World Trade Center case, into the World Trade Center, and basically the government charged him with renting a Ryder van in Jersey City, and it was the government's theory that he drove this van in the early morning hours of February 26th into the basement area, garage area of the World Trade Center, and that the explosion then occurred and tragically killed six people and injured many and caused millions of dollars in damage. Now, his defense was basically that the van that he rented was stolen from him several hours before the explosion. And so the trial, although there were four defendants on trial, for my defense, we concentrated on trying to basically show that his defense that this van had been stolen was in fact truthful.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment as we begin bringing on other stations onto our little network here. And so we'll be back talking to Mr. Robert Precht about this fascinating book, Defending Muhammad. And you'll find, as we begin getting into this, that there were a lot of improprieties in this trial, which he brings out and brings out very well. Well, good afternoon. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Robert Precht, who is a lawyer and who had a fascinating adventure a little over a decade ago, because he was assigned as a public defender to defend Mohammed Salami, who was the man who had driven the, or at least accused of driving the van that went into the basement of the World Trade Center. And when that bomb went off, why, there were six people killed. There were 1,000 people injured. There was almost $500 million worth of damage then. It was a first major terrorist attack on American soil. And, of course, Robert Precht has the responsibility for defending this man. He was really didn't look like a very aggressive individual. Wasn't he a very mild manner, very slightly built person who almost was sort of pitiful in the situation he was in?
You describe it perfectly. I mean, what was so surprising to me is that before this case, I had had no experience with terrorism except those terrible images from the 70s in which airliners were blown up on the Egyptian desert and things of that sort. And so when I first was called to represent this man, I expected somehow to encounter, or I was expecting to see the face of evil, whatever that means, but someone almost who looks like the devil. But I was surprised to confront instead a man sitting in the corner of a room, slumped over, slightly built, and as I can best describe it, he looked like a small, defeated-like bird-like figure, totally perplexed as to why he had been arrested, fearful and bewildered, and looking to me to basically explain what was happening to him.
And, of course, his defense was that the truck, this Ryder van that he had rented, had been stolen from him. He even reported it to the police.
That's right. What was interesting about this case, of course, is that the government charged that he rented the van, and actually the government believed that he had driven the van himself to the World Trade Center. But, of course, his alibi was that he had been shopping the night before and the van had been stolen. And interestingly enough, not only did he report the van stolen, but he actually met up with police officers and drove around in a police car looking for the van. Now, the government said that this was somehow a diabolical criminal who was, in effect, paving the way for his defense. We argued that it showed his innocent state of mind and that...
Hold that thought for just
sure.
A minute. We have to bring one more station on, and when we get that on, then we don't have any interruptions for 12 long minutes. All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Mr. Robert Precht. We're talking about his book, Defending Mohammed, a very important part of this whole puzzle of what happened at that time. And Mr. Precht was describing the defense that was put forward. Now, the government accused Salami of actually driving the yellow van into the basement of the World Trade Center building, but he was a terrible driver. In fact, he'd been involved in at least one accident. Nobody wanted to drive with him because he was just so totally incompetent as a driver. He had had accidents driving down a straight road and run off the road. I guess it was a mild turn of the road. He just forgot to turn, and both he and Ramzi Yosef, who he was living with, who was the real bomb maker, were injured, or at least one of them threw it out of the car, the other slumped over in the front seat. And you made that part of the defense, part of your defense argument in reply to the government's charge that he was driving the van. Do you want to describe that?
Sure.
I thought that was really great.
Well, basically, the government, the prosecutors argued that the mastermind had basically selected my client, Mohammed Salami, to drive the van to the World Trade Center. And so there was also evidence that in the weeks before the actual bombing, my client had been involved in at least two auto accidents, one of them actually involving Ramzi Yousef. Ramzi Yousef and Mohammed Salami were driving one day, and Mohammed Salami was at the wheel, and the road conditions were perfect. It was a clear day, And a police officer came and testified that he responded to the scene of an accident, and there was Mohammed Salami slumped over the wheel, and Ramzi Youssef, the alleged mastermind, slumped on the front car seat. And I tried to, in my summation, cast doubt on the believability that this mastermind would have selected a man that he had just been involved in an accident with just a few months, a few weeks earlier. And so I literally tried to kind of conjure up a scene for the jury, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, the government would have you believe that Mr. Salami was selected for this important mission by Ramzi Youssef. Now imagine the scene. Ramzi Youssef is driving with my client in this car, my client at the wheel, and there's this auto wreck in broad daylight. And then I asked the jury, well, now imagine Ramzi Youssef as he's trying to regain consciousness, all has a brilliant idea. He's finally found the man. He wants to drive the van that contains the bomb to the World Trade Center.
And you actually got the jury laughing at that time.
Yes, it was actually a point that I had the jury actually laughing at the prosecutor's allegations, and I was at least happy to put a different light on the evidence.
Well, the problem was that Salami had actually been a roommate with Ramzi Youssef, and Ramzi Youssef, I don't think anybody questions it, he was the master bomb maker, and Ramzi Youssef was working with Osama bin Laden. He'd been trained in Osama bin Laden's terrorist camps along with other people, and then of course Salami had rented a room where apparently the bomb was built.
Yes.
He had been a roommate with Ramzi Youssef,
right.
And he had actually rented the yellow truck, so they had an awful lot of evidence pointing there, but they really couldn't, it was all circumstantial. And the most significant thing to me about this case was that the government didn't abide by the law. In other words, they had told the judge ahead of time something that they never should have told the judge, that would prejudice him, so that there was no way that Salami could get a fair trial. And even though he may very well have been totally guilty of all the charges that were made, two of the co-defendants had actually made plea agreements with the government and told everything that had happened and incriminated Salami. And then the government canceled the plea agreements, and they told the judge. Now, they weren't supposed to tell the judge, were they?
No, I really don't think so. And I think you really raise a key point, and that is the importance of giving a fair trial, whether or not the person is in fact guilty. That's a basic principle. And the idea behind a fair trial is to have an impartial jury and judge, people who have not made up their minds, people who will keep an open mind and listen to the evidence. And what happened in this case is that the prosecutors basically disclosed secret statements made by the other defendants to the judge, that these other statements and the other defendants actually implicated Salami. These statements were never put into evidence in the courtroom, were never tested in cross-examination, but the judge apparently got these statements, and not only that, he read the statements and he told me and my partner in the robing room in a closed session, and I'm quoting almost verbatim, the judge said that I think your client did it, and I'm fairly certain he'll be convicted. And this was several weeks before all the evidence had finally come in. And so I made probably the biggest mistake of the case when I failed to ask the judge to remove himself on the grounds that he was biased. I didn't ask him to do that because I thought that he would surely deny the motion and make it difficult for me to try the rest of the case. But in retrospect, that was a serious mistake because it really goes to the heart of what is a fair trial, and that is an impartial judge.
Well, what the prosecution had done is they had all of these planned leaks to the media. Now, this is dishonest. You're not supposed to do it. But they did it, and they would put these leaks out, and they would say, somebody sent Mohammed Salami $100,000 he deposited in his account there. Not a bit of truth in it, but you created that impression in the minds of everybody who read the newspapers. So they tried this case in the media before it ever got into court, so you couldn't get an impartial jury, because they all believed that he had gotten $100,000 to build this bomb. And what was he at? $8,000, I don't know where he got it, but that was all the money that they had.
Right, and you know, the problem is that the government, the FBI agents, and actually the assistant director of the FBI would leak this evidence anonymously to the New York newspapers, and of course they would immediately report these leaks as established truth. And as you note, many of these leaks were completely unfounded and never saw the light of day in the courtroom during the trial. But the problem is that millions of people had read these newspaper articles, and we believed that it's very possible these leaks had poisoned the jury pool, which would make it very difficult for us to select an impartial jury. So that was really one of the terrible parts of this case, is that basically, if you can believe it, the government leaked almost the entire evidence of what it tried to present at trial, leaked all of that evidence before trial, including allegations that they never, some serious allegations that they never did present at trial. And so you did have this spectacle of the defendants being tried in public, in the media, before they ever entered the courtroom.
And the other thing that really bothered me is they leaked things that really weren't true at all, and we see this constant pattern all the time. You know, the CIA, this is on a different subject, but the CIA leaks this story. The CIA doesn't leak a story. I mean, that story is being put out to influence the public.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories that were leaked to the public in reference to this trial were done intentionally so that you couldn't possibly get a fair trial even if the man was innocent.
Well, that's certainly what I believed, and I think people were trying to take, you know, the FBI agents were trying to take credit. And, you know, you mentioned the CIA, but we're still seeing that. I mean, don't get me wrong. Look, I hate terrorists, and I believe that they should be punished to the full extent of the law. But we need to be fair about this. And we just recently had a case in which the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, when anyone is arrested and accused of terrorism, he is proclaiming to the media that the government has successfully seized terrorists before there's been any judgment in a court of law that that's the case.
Well, there is a number of irregularities in this trial, and one of them, of course, was the judge was prejudiced against you from the very beginning. In fact, he did everything he could to put you into a defensive position, so you were always looking over your shoulder. He was threatening to have you disbarred. He would pick up some minor little discrepancy, anything he could, and I think he was honestly playing games with you. Did you have that feeling, looking back on it, that he was there to intimidate you so you couldn't do a good job?
Well, you know, looking back on it, I do believe that. However, in the spirit of the book, I also have to take part of the blame, in the sense that, you know, my childhood hero, and when I went to law school, my hero was Clarence Darrow. And so, although I had the task of representing this individual, there was a part of me that became a bit intoxicated with being involved in a high-profile case, and I started to fancy myself a modern version of Clarence Darrow.
How about and, Perry Mason?
Yes. And, you know, I, in an effort to curb these efforts by the government to leak evidence and to prejudice the jury, I certainly talked to the media, and that irritated the judge. And the big problem I had is that when I first appeared for the judge attempted to impose a gag order. I argued that it was too little and too late, and that I should have the opportunity to respond if there were new leaks, and I appealed that order. I successfully got that order overturned, but ever since or after that, the judge really made it difficult for me, and I do believe he intimidated my bosses and wanted to keep me on a leash, so to speak.
And he certainly, you know, he did this very effectively by really saying that if you made one more mistake, he was going to get you disbarred. And how can you possibly present a case effectively when you know the judge is against you? And he's let you know that. And some of the things he even wrote to you were totally inappropriate for any judge. And I wouldn't even on a family radio station repeat one of the messages he sent to you. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Mr. Robert Preck, talking about his book, Defending Mohammed, a very important part of history. Let me tell you about some of the four tape sets we have. One special tape set is the Tuskegee Study, and it's four interviews with people who were involved with the Tuskegee Study, or at least who've gone into the background of this really most horrible of all American experimentation. We had the unique opportunity to interview a number of the men who were involved in analyzing the Tuskegee Study, a government-sponsored study where 400 black men were recruited. And they had syphilis, and of course, what they did not understand is that they were not being recruited to be treated, they were being recruited not to be treated, and the government agents did everything they could to block those men from receiving treatment for their syphilis. Call today at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. It's important that you understand that study so you can better understand the mentality of the men who are working behind the scenes in America today.
Hello, this is health journalist Bill Sardi, and there's no better time to establish a biological response kit in your home. In an age when we hear about biological threats, more common are cases of E. coli in our food, cryptosporidium in our tap water, and staph germs, viruses, and molds in our air conditioning systems. Why be a sitting duck and run to the doctor after you've got a problem? Why not take something to stay healthy, like Alamex, the all-new 100% pure allicin garlic extract. You won't find Alamex in stores, but you'll find it by calling 866-405-4000. Alamex is equivalent to 15 cloves of fresh crushed garlic. And guess what? It's odor-free. Call 866-405-4000.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I want to remind everybody within our listening audience that we're going to be having a Radio Liberty day-long conference at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course here on the North Shore of Monterey Bay. It's going to be on the 29th of November. That's, just about a week and a half from now. And we're going to be bringing speakers in from across the country. And you'll find a fascinating discussion of many of the questions that you may wonder about. The USA Patriot Act, what's really in the act? How many people do you know who've really read the entire USA Patriot Act and can discuss it intelligently? Well, you'll be fascinated by Joan Parris' presentation. And then, of course, we get to the issues of why are we really in Iraq? Are we there because we're really concerned about democracy? Or did we think we were going to trap Osama bin Laden by attacking Iraq? Are we there for the oil? Are we there for economics to prevent, to stabilize the dollar? Or are there other agendas behind what really is going on? And we're going to be discussing that. We're going to be discussing the Supreme Court's decisions. We're going to be discussing what's happening in the Christian church today. It's going to be a fascinating program. Now, we're going to provide lunch, so we have to charge for the day. But I think you'll find it fascinating. We hope many of you will want to go. If you'd like to get a flyer on this, you could get to your friends so that you could invite them. If you just give us a call, we'd be glad to send you or fax you a flyer that you can get out in your community. You make announcements in your church or your clubs or your neighborhood. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you a flyer. And even better, we hope, of course, you'll sign up for the full-day seminar. It's going to begin early in the morning. You should be there shortly after 8. Hopefully, even some people will be there before 8, because we're going to start right at 8:30 in the morning, and you don't want to miss the first speaker. Because nobody wanted to be the first speaker, so my staff decided I would be the first speaker. I think you'll find it a fascinating program. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. Robert Preck. We're talking about his book, Defending Mohammed. And the book is about as much about the legal system as about the defense of Mr. Salami. And, of course, you have to understand that when the legal system begins to break down and when prosecutors are beginning to violate the law to win, and they have the cooperation of the courts, and in this instance, I personally believe Mr. Salami was as guilty as sin. But what happens if he isn't guilty? And they are just determined they're going to get a connection, a conviction. And they use the media, and they leak stories that aren't true, and they poison the jury pool. And then the judge takes on the defense attorney, so he really can't present the information because the judge is convicted, is concerned, or is convinced from the very, very beginning that the defendant is guilty because the prosecution has told him that they're guilty. They have a secret confession from somebody else that's incriminated him. And this is a frightening thing. You have to have an impartial judge. That's what judges are all about. And what is so frightening is when you have a judge who's made up his mind ahead of time, well, then what chance does the defendant have whether he is innocent or guilty? And what a terrible thing to think that innocent people can be convicted in our court system. And as you point out, you were close to Mr. Kunstler, at least. He was coming to visit you. And I want to tell a little bit about William Kunstler, because he's a very colorful individual. A lot of people didn't like him. I remember when I was very young, I didn't like him because he was always on the wrong side. But he was really an idealist in some ways, wasn't he?
Yes, and actually, Dr. Stan, I didn't like him either when I was a youngster. I remember watching him as a high school student. But William Kunstler was really a legendary lawyer. He got his fame in the 1960s by representing political radicals, radicals on the left. He defended a number of people involved in the Chicago 1968 demonstrations, and he made it a practice to defend the unpopular, to defend the underdog. And during the case, he asked to speak to us, and he basically took me to task for being too mild-mannered. I mean, basically his position, and, you know, he looks like, or he's deceased, but in those days, you know, he looked like the image of a biblical patriarch. He was a big guy and flowing gray hair, chiseled face, and he was very warm. But he sat me down and he said, you know, look what's going on here. You see that the government is leaking evidence. The government is intimidating witnesses, and there had just been some rather dramatic testimony in which one of the government witnesses had actually been testifying under the threat that if he didn't give evidence favorable to the government would throw this immigrant out of the country. And so he said, you have this evidence that people are being intimidated. There's no way your client's going to get a fair trial, so why are you, Rob Precht, playing so mild-mannered? I mean, you should basically be much more aggressive and confrontational and saying to the judge, this is a mockery, this is not a fair trial, and bringing the world's attention to what is happening. But I took the position, I was with my boss at the time, you know, we were part of an institution and that we basically had to play by the rules and not do anything confrontational.
But as you pointed out, and I thought that this was really frightening, that you actually had investigators to go out to talk to some of the witnesses.
Right.
And the witnesses had been told, you're not to talk. The FBI had told those witnesses, you're not to talk to anybody. You're not going to give any information to the other side that might help to get their people off. You're not to talk to anybody else. Where does the FBI get off telling people that they can't talk to investigators from the defense?
Well, I know. I think it's really a terrible thing because, you know, shortly after I got the case, of course, I hired an investigator, a Muslim investigator, to go to Jersey City, where Salami lived, and he had friends. And this investigator kept coming back to me and saying that as soon as I identified myself as working for the Legal Aid Society, everyone said, oh, I can't talk to you. The FBI has said that we can't talk to you. And that scenario was actually confirmed in the courtroom when, again, there was this witness who was obviously testifying very reluctantly for the government. On cross-examination, he admitted that the reason he was testifying is that the government has seized his immigration papers and was threatening to throw him out of the country unless this witness testified in a manner that pleased the government.
And so much for a free trial with honest witnesses. And when you have sometimes plea agreements where people will say whatever they want to so that they don't go to jail, and they'll get up on the stand and they'll lie, and the government knows they're lying and lets them lie. Ladies and gentlemen, we got a real problem. We have to get back to a moral system, because without morality, there is no freedom. We'll be right back and welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Would you believe that there is an organized effort to dumb down children all across America? As we see falling SAT scores, it's very easy to say, well, gee, we need to just spend more money. That'll solve our problem. Ladies and gentlemen, that won't solve the problem at all, because there is an organized program within the hierarchy of education to dumb down our children intentionally. Outcome-based education is a fascinating book written by Pamela Hobbs Hopker and Pat Lutzik, going into the background of the program of the humanists who gained control of the educational establishment in the United States to change the attitude of our children, to change their attitude towards God and family and country. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for outcome-based education. Once you understand what they're doing to your children, you'll never look at the world through the same eyes again. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just want to mention here one of the items that we carry that we think is an excellent thing that you should have is a Big Berkey or a Berkey Light water filter, and these are designed specifically so you can use them with any sort of water you want to, pond water, pool water, river water. It's what the missionaries have used around the world for 150 years. The Big Berkey is made out of stainless steel. You pour a couple of gallons of water in the top. It goes through ceramic filters that are packed inside with activated carbon. The water comes out below. It's potable because almost most of the chemicals and herbicides and pesticides, the chlorine taste is removed. And if you are out there and you're spending a lot of money on bottled water, in fact, we had one parent who told me she bought one of these for her son, actually was the Berkey Light, because she was spending a fortune on bottled water. And so both he and all the young people in their home, I think there were five boys living there, are using that and getting water they're just as happy with. And so if you'd like to get the Big Berkey, they're $239.95. And if you buy them through us, you get a four-tape set or video we produce, but they aren't available in California or Iowa. They're available every other place, but not in California or Iowa. However, the Berkey Light, which is made of Lexan, same design, only it's transparent, so you can see the water level, which I happen to like. And then the filters are what we call black Berkey filters. They're much more efficient. We call them water purifiers rather than water filters, but they have to be changed every 2 to 4 years. Both the Big Berkey and the Berkey Light have special filters that will take the fluoride out. If you want to get rid of the fluoride, and if you're in the fluoridated area, don't drink the water. Find another alternative. Buy bottled water if you want to, but if you want the Big Berkey, you can get or the Berkey Light, you can get that. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the Berkey or Berkey Light. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Robert Precht, and the story is Defending Muhammad and subtitled Justice on Trial. William Kunstler was involved in another court case at that time, and what had happened was that the original bombing of the World Trade Center had occurred in February of 1993, and then shortly thereafter, of course, what had happened was the government had an infiltrator, had a man working within this Islamic terrorist group in New York City, and when he went to the FBI and said, look, they want me to build 12 bombs, and I'm supposed to build the bombs. Will you give me some powders that won't go off? What did the FBI and their brilliance do? Why, they put him in a situation where he had to resign. They insisted he expose himself, that endanger his wife and family and endanger his own life. and wear a wire and then appear in court without any guarantee of witness protection or anything. And he just said, sayonara, he just left. And he kept telling the FBI, though, that there is a terrorist cell and they're going to do terrible things. And then, of course, the World Trade Center is blown up. Well, then the FBI is afraid the American people are going to find out about this, and why that would make the FBI look terrible. They'd been told that there was this plan, so they went out and hired this man back. He'd been working for $500 a month. Now they're going to pay him $1.5 million to infiltrate the this terrorist group again, and they find out that they're planning on blowing up the Harlem Tunnel, and they're going to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge and a whole flock of sites in New York. So these people are all arrested, and William Kunstler is defending them, so that trial is going on at the same time your trial is going on, isn't it?
Right. It was going on at the same time, and what was particularly odd about it was that in my case, the prosecutors were arguing that the mastermind behind the World Trade Center bombing was this fugitive named Ramzi Youssef, this Iraqi citizen. But in the Kunstler case, and that, as you correctly noted, that was a case that charged a sheikh in Jersey City and his followers with being involved in a huge plot to not only blow up the World Trade Center, but other landmarks. In that case, the prosecutors were arguing that it was this blind sheikh who was the mastermind. And so we were very perplexed as to what was the government's theory here. How could you have two masterminds operating apparently independently?
Well, one of the things that, well, first of all, that was the Sheikh Omar Rockman,
yes,
the blind sheikh. But one of the things that really intrigued me about your book, you told me, you talk about how the prosecution opens by saying, we are going to prove that Ramzi Youssef, now he was the bomb maker, he was the mastermind behind the first World Trade Center bombing, and really the mastermind behind the second World Trade Center bombing. He had laid out the plan. It was picked up by his uncle, who is Sheikh Mohammed, Caliph Mohammed, and he carried out the plan, even though Ramzi Youssef by this time was in prison in the United States, had been imprisoned. But it was the same plan that he laid out in 1995, and the government knew about that. But the significant thing was that they opened the prosecution saying that Ramzi Youssef and who was the other fellow who was at who came in the country with him?
That was Ajaj.
Ajaj. I'm trying to figure out how Ajaj. A-J-A-J.
Yes.
And that they had attended in an Islamic terrorist training camp in, was that Afghanistan or Pakistan?
Doesn't
really
matter. Yes, that's right, that area.
And it back, you know, in 1992 when this whole plot was being hatched out, now that was obviously a bin Laden training camp, wasn't it? How did the government know he'd been there?
Well, that's a good question. The government had secret sources of information that they never revealed to the defense. However, they had some kind of a paper trail. There was evidence of airplane tickets and some evidence as to where these individuals had been. But there were plenty of other sources of information that we never saw.
Well, I thought that was you as a defense attorney had a right to have all the information that the prosecution had. I mean, don't you as a defense attorney have that right? And don't you have the right to question some of these people ahead of time? I know certainly in civil litigation you have a right to question the witnesses before the trial, the defense does. Do you have that right as a federal cases or what?
Well, that's a great question, because you know, you would think that in a civil case, when people's when the stakes are not people's lives, or the stakes are not a person going to prison, in civil cases the lawyers get to preview each other's case. You know, if there's a plaintiff filing a lawsuit against a defendant, the defendant's lawyers can get all sorts of what's called discovery and basically see all of the evidence before it ever comes into the courtroom. But ironically, in a criminal case, where the stakes are much higher, we're not just talking about money, but we're talking possibly very long prison terms or even the death penalty, the defense has absolutely no right to see the government's evidence, with one narrow exception, and that is evidence that actually shows that the defendant is innocent, that casts doubt on the government's evidence. That kind of evidence must be disclosed to the defense. But as a practical matter, That very seldom happens because the government always takes the position that this evidence doesn't show innocence.
Because if it shows innocence, they wouldn't be sending an innocent man to jail.
Well, one would hope not.
Sort of like Martha Stewart, because she had made a public statement that her stockholders heard that she wasn't guilty. Why now they're charging with criminal charges for misinforming her the people, her stockholders, and embezzling them and cheating them out of money because, of course, she said she wasn't guilty, and that's a serious charge. And they're going to hold her to that. I mean, can you imagine somebody says, I'm not guilty, and, well, obviously you're guilty because you said you weren't guilty, and now you've committed a terrible crime because the government went after you and the value of your stock fell and these people lost a lot of money, so you're responsible for that. And I just don't understand the rationale. But one of the things you talked about was that you were trying to get the information from the government, and they would bring you box after box after box, a tremendous amount of material that you could never hope to possibly go through, like they were trying to bury you with information. Did you have that feeling?
Yes, I definitely had the feeling. You know, we need to remember that with this World Trade Center bombing, I mean, the FBI and the government agencies, they literally had thousands of people working on this case, and thousands and millions of dollars. We, on the other hand, as a public defender with limited funds, we had one investigator and a few thousand dollars to do our investigation. And so we did the best we could. We hired an expert from Britain to analyze the chemical evidence, the bomb evidence itself. But basically, it was me. And I had to digest all of this evidence, and I did definitely get the feeling that the government was just sending me tons and tons of irrelevant evidence, not because they wanted to disclose anything to me, but quite the opposite, that they were hoping to overwhelm me with so much stuff to read that I would be unable to actually spot what was relevant.
And so they're really playing games, and that's not right. They should give you the information rather than totally manipulate you if they're really interested in a fair trial. Now, one of the interesting things was the FBI lab report. And, of course, most people think, well, if it comes from the FBI, it's got to be good, because I see Sue Thomas FBI, and I see all these television programs and the FBI, and gee, these are wonderful people. But actually, there were people in the FBI lab who were putting out phony information, weren't there?
Yes, and that was probably one of the most shocking things to happen, because, and I'm speaking not just as a lawyer, but as an American, because as you correctly note, we depend on the FBI. We don't have the resources to do our own analysis of chemical evidence, but what happened in the Trade Center case was this, is that there were a number of scientists who were working on the evidence, and basically they concluded that it was impossible, given the state of the debris at the World Trade Center, to pinpoint the exact components, the chemical components of the bomb. That was their conclusion as scientists. And when they took that conclusion to their supervisor within the lab, the supervisor basically was very unhappy and asked them to slant their evidence, to basically suggest, he told the scientists, in effect, we should suggest that we can identify the contents of the bomb.
In other words, lie.
Yes.
And this
why?
This was the FBI lab, you have to understand. Go ahead.
And actually what happened at trial is that the scientists, or at least one of the scientists, actually testify, and he said, as a scientist, I cannot identify the contents of the bomb.
No, was that Frederick Whitehurst?
Yes. Actually, it was his colleague Burmeister.
All right.
Who testified. And so you have the scientists testifying this way. The prosecutors have just heard this. What do the prosecutors do then? As their last witness, they call the scientist supervisor. This was the supervisor who had pressured them to slant their findings in the first place, and this supervisor of the FBI lab then basically contradicted the scientists and said, I can identify the contents of the bomb by just looking at the distribution of the bomb wreckage. And he then identified the contents, and those contents matched chemicals that were possessed by the defendants. 3 years later, however, the supervisor was investigated, and in an official report by the Inspector General, the report said that basically this supervisor had lied, that he could not, through any scientific means, identify the contents, and that he had basically perjured himself. but it was, of course, too late for the defendants.
Now, I think we have actually a four-tape set on the FBI, and, of course, a couple of those tapes are with Frederick Whitehurst, where he tells much the same story, and some of the things he told me are really frightening. But what is even more disturbing is that the prosecutors in this case put the supervisor on, knowing full well that his testimony was not going to be true. Isn't that subjourning, or what do they call it, suborning testimony? What's the term?
Suborning perjury, and there are strict rules that when the prosecutor obviously may not knowingly put on false evidence, but this is exactly what happened, because the prosecutors were already on notice that this supervisor, his name was Dave Williams, had pressured the scientists, because they had a letter from Whitehurst saying that Williams had pressured Whitehurst and his colleague Burmeister. So the prosecutors were on notice that David Williams was pressuring scientists in the lab to cook the evidence. And yet, the prosecutors called this very supervisor as their last witness to summarize all of the physical evidence. And that is, of course, when he lied.
Well, you know, my concern, reading your book, is the fact that if you do not have a legitimate court system, then no man's life or property is safe. And we have a lot of good lawyers, and we have a lot of good judges, but we have some that really aren't interested in the law at all. They're interested in simply winning the case. Are you concerned about that?
I am concerned about that, Dr. Stan. You know, as a lawyer, one of the big things that I learned by doing this case was that as a lawyer and as a law student, you know, I used to think that if you just followed the rules, you were going to be all right. You were going to, you know, if you follow the rules for giving a person a fair trial, you know, follow the procedures, that you'll get a fair trial. What I didn't realize is that the rules depend on human beings to give those rules life to. And unless the human beings are approaching their job in a moral, ethical way, the rules are virtually useless. They can be bent and create real unfairness. And so it is my concern. And you know, it's not that these prosecutors and the FBI have evil motives. I mean, that would be in a way comforting if we just thought that these people were evil people. The problem is that these people have good motives from their standpoint. They want to use the legal system to stop terrorism. Yet, as the old saying goes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. People can still do terrible things with the best of intentions.
Well, I have read Stephen Jones' book. He was the one who defended Timothy McVeigh, and his books, Others Unknown and Others Unknown, the Oklahoma bombing conspiracy, were two books. And he said that the one thing that disturbed him most as a former member of the ACLU and truly an idealistic lawyer was he feared that, you know, it was impossible under certain circumstances to get a fair trial. Now, certainly we can get some fair trials, and I've had a couple of minor cases, and I felt that I always had a fair trial. But when we see something of this magnitude, and this was so vitally important, and I have very little question in my mind that Salami was involved in this, that there was a conspiracy, but at least the government had to be able to prove that, and they could have actually done that if they'd gone through with their plea agreements with the other people there. And you, of course, talk about maybe the advantage in to having a capital punishment in the for federal crimes is that at least you can take that off the table and get the plea agreement and get the truth out. At least you would have something more to bargain with.
That's right.
Well, did everybody in the trial get a life sentence?
Yes, they did. This was before 1993 when the explosion occurred. That was during a period of time when there was no valid federal death penalty. The Supreme Court had ruled that the earlier death penalty was unconstitutional, so there was no valid death penalty at the time. However, right after the Trade Center trial, Congress enacted a death penalty statute, so it's unquestionable that individuals would be facing the death penalty now.
Well, now, there was one fellow who had been in jail at the time of that. That was Ajaj.
Ajaj, right.
Right, and he had actually been in jail, but he'd come into the country at the same time as Ramzi Yosef, and even though there was no way he could have been involved with the explosion, he got a life sentence as well.
He sure did, and, you know, that's one of the other technical issues in these cases is conspiracy law. conspiracy is basically, it's called the darling of prosecutors because it allows prosecutors to convict people who really may only have associated with certain people. It allows the prosecutor to convict people who do very, very minor things that may happen to further a crime. And Ajaj's lawyer argued basically that Ajaj was simply accompanying the Ramzi Youssef and had nothing to do with it. And indeed, he was in jail. It's indisputed he was in jail at the time of the explosion. But the prosecutor successfully argued that Ajaj nevertheless was a member of this larger conspiracy, and that by accompanying Ramzi Youssef and perhaps distracting customs officials from Ramzi Youssef, that he furthered the conspiracy and therefore is, yes, in jail for the rest of his life.
And the thing that bothered me was the fact that they played on the emotions of the jurors. They brought in all these pictures and the horror and the tragedy had nothing to do with whether these men were guilty or not. They were manipulating the jurors. Did you have that feeling?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was it's incredibly tragic, and no one, I mean, I'm certainly not devaluing the suffering of the victims and the horror of it all, but government basically, the prosecutors used the first month of testimony simply describing the horror of the crime, the destruction and the suffering of the victims. And the point is that no one was claiming, the defense wasn't claiming that people didn't suffer. The defense was claiming that the government got the wrong guys, but the government wanted to put the spotlight on the suffering and basically encourage the jury, inflame the jury against the defendant.
We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. It's been a great hour, and thank you so much for writing the book.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your great questions.
Bye-bye. Let me tell you about some of the four tape sets we have. One special tape set is the Tuskegee Study, and it's four interviews with people who were involved with the Tuskegee Study, or at least who've gone into the background of this really most horrible of all American experimentation. We had the unique opportunity to interview a number of the men who were involved in analyzing the Tuskegee Study, a government-sponsored study where 400 black men were recruited. And they had syphilis, and of course, what they did not understand is that they were not being recruited to be treated. They were being recruited not to be treated, and the government agents did everything they could to block those men from receiving treatment for their syphilis. Call today at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. It's important that you understand that study so you can better understand the mentality of the men who are working behind the scenes in America today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at, Radio Liberty, and I just want to mention that we carry Miracle 2 soap products, and we carry them because we think that they're beneficial, and maybe even more so than simply soap. They're excellent soap, but we get all sorts of reports from people who use these products telling all sorts of amazing things. All we can do is tell you that we have been told by some of the people who use it that it's really helped their acne, it's helped their rashes, it's helped their stomachs, upper intestine, lower intestine. I can just simply suggest that you try the products if you'd like to. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And there's a soap, and there's a moisturizing soap, and there's a gel and a lotion, and there is a neutralizer, which is a very alkaline solution, a heavily mineralized solution. And people take these things, and, well, they seem to feel better. If you'd like to know more about them, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com or give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for a special introductory offer. And then with Christmas coming up, we hope that many of you will seriously consider getting a Phenoply set for your children or grandchildren. We had a woman who called today who actually bought three of them. And this is a wonderful way to teach children how to read phonetically and pronounce words phonetically and spell phonetically. It's designed to play like a fun game, like Monopoly on a board. Actually, it's five board games, two bonus games, and we throw in a couple of books that explain that there's been an organized effort to dumb down children all across the United States, and it's really worked very effectively. There really are evil people out there. But nobody wants to address that issue. So if you'd like to get a Phenopoly set, and not the $300, $400, $500, $600, this is $139.95. That's $139.95 plus shipping. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for Phenopoly. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Mr. Robert Precht. It's really a fascinating book, and well worthwhile. If you want to get copies, we can get them for you here at Radio Liberty. But we have so many books we hope that you will want to get as Christmas presents. Certainly, we believe that Dr. Russell Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, would be an excellent gift, and you can get that. Or you can get that along with the four-tape set, Life-Saving Secrets, and interviews with Dr. Blaylock and on the issues that face us from a health point of view. And then, of course, we have excellent book called Crude Politics Goes into the Background of Our War in Afghanistan, where we never tried to get Osama bin Laden. Our boys were there, of course, to take out the Taliban so we could get the oil line through. The book is written by Paul Sperry, senior correspondent for WorldNet Daily in Washington, D.C. He talks to the Green Berets as they come back, the special forces. They were never allowed to try to get Osama bin Laden. We didn't go there to get Osama bin Laden, but we had to tell the American people that. How else would you get him to go to war? And then, of course, we have to attack Iraq because we've got to get rid of that wicked Osama bin Laden and all those wicked terrorists. So we attack Iraq, and then we can't even find a Saddam Hussein, and there's something wrong with what's going on. And the truth of the matter is we're not going to pull our troops out of the Middle East. We plan to station them permanently. And if you doubt that, why, you only need to go to the website, newamericancentury.org, which is put up by the Project for the New American Century, to which Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton and so many of the people who control the Bush administration today laid out their plan back in 1997 for the new international order, where our troops are stationed all over the world permanently. And we know what happened to ancient Rome when they did that. Why, when the Huns came in, there wasn't anybody to defend Rome. And nobody really cared at that point because there was such depravity among the people of Rome. Could it happen here? Well, I would like to suggest that it can, and you better understand what's going on and get our information. You can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, pull down our newsletters, and then check the documentation that we have. Go to the various websites. We tell you they aren't our websites. They're put out by the other side, the wicked people who have seized control of our government, specifically NewAmericanCentury.org. NewAmericanCentury.org, and you'll get all the references in our March 2003 newsletter. Remember our website, www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day. You can pull down our newsletters. You can read many of the essays we have. Please tell others about our website. Tell them about our programs. Get them involved in listening. And then, of course, while you're on the website, look at the various items we carry, because some of these do help us to stay on the air. We do carry the Berkey products, and if you buy them through us, the Big Berkey and the Berkey Light, you'll get a free video or four-tape set that we produced. And then there's so many other things up there, the pictures of the Phenopoly set and the Robinson Homeschool curriculum and the various items that we think are important. We hope that many of you will get involved with the Institute of the Constitution and begin pushing these programs to teach people about America's heritage in your community, in your church. If we don't understand where we came from, how can we understand where we are today or where we're headed? Learn about America's Christian heritage from the Institute of the Constitution. You can get their website from our website, and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so we want to remind you about the special conference we're going to have on the 29th, all day long here in the North Shore of the Monterey Bay. If there's any way you can get down, please give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We have to have his reservations. And until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.